Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're really getting into the essentials of spina bifida. It's a condition that, you know, touches so many specialties. Our aim here is to pull out the key facts, connect the dots between the anatomy and how patients actually function, and maybe shed some light on those management debates you need to be aware of. We're going to talk about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vayet. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Absolutely. And spina bifida, it's really a spectrum, isn't it? To understand it, you have to go right back to the beginning. We're talking about a failure of the neural tube to close properly during embryonic development. That one initial event, well, it really sets everything else in motion. All the neurological, the urological, the orthopedic complications we see later on, they stem from that. Hashtag tag Cali AI. Defining the spectrum of spina bifida.
Okay, so let's unpack that spectrum. Starting with the name itself, spina bifida, it's Latin, right?
Yeah, literally spine in two parts.
And that refers to the vertebral arches not fusing.
Exactly. That failure of the bones at the back to close up.
Now, you said it can happen anywhere along the spine, but is there a common spot?
Oh, definitely. The vast majority, they're concentrated down in the lumbosacral region, lower back.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the exact level isn't always the most critical thing initially. It's more about what is actually involved in the defect. Is something protruding?
Mm.
And if so, what? That's what really defines the three main types and, well, shapes the prognosis.
Right. So let's start with the mildest one, spina bifida occulta. The sources call it occult hidden. My understanding is the defect is purely bony. The posterior elements fail to fuse. But crucially, the dura, the neural stuff, it's all unaffected. Is that the key differentiator?
That's absolutely spot on. The spinal cord, the meninges, they're fine. They're not involved. And because of that, even though it's surprisingly common, maybe 10% or more of people might have it, it usually doesn't cause any real symptoms.
So often found by accident, maybe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Incidentally, on an x-ray for something else entirely. Okay, moving along that spectrum. Then we get to meningocele.
Meningocele. So here, the bony defect is there again, but this time something does protrude.
Yes. The dura and the arachnoid tissue push out, forming this fluid-filled sac that you can often see on the back.
Ah, okay. But the vital distinction here, compared to the next type, is that the spinal cord itself isn't in that sac.
Correct. No neural elements in the sac, just the membranes and fluid.
So functionally, what does that mean for the patient? It varies a bit.
It does vary. Some might have very few symptoms. Others could have some degree of paralysis or dysfunction. It depends. But generally, the outlook is better than for the most severe form.
Which brings us to myelomeningocele.
Myelomeningocele. This is the most severe, the most complex form. Here, the sac that protrudes doesn't just contain the meninges and fluid. It also includes the spinal cord itself or other neural elements.
Wow. So the nerve tissue is right there, exposed or damaged.
Exactly. And because of that direct involvement of the neural tissue, the outcome is, well, uniformly challenging. You're looking at partial or complete nerve dysfunction below the level of that spinal opening.
Which translates to paralysis.
Yes, invariably paralysis and also really significant problems with bladder and bowel control. It's a lifelong multi-system issue. Hashtag tag tag two, the functional consequence of lesion level.
Okay, that uniform dysfunction you mentioned in myelomeningocele that leads us straight into the practical orthopedic side of things. Probably the biggest question is always, how does the specific level of the defect predict, you know, how well a child might eventually walk? Ambulation potential.
Right. And the guiding principle is pretty straightforward. Function is impaired at the level of the defect. So it's the lowest normally functioning neurological level that dictates what they can do.
Okay.
When we talk about mobility, specifically walking, there's often kind of a line drawn in the sand, neurologically speaking, usually between the L3 and L5 levels.
Right. I've heard that. We often talk about an L5 functional level being sort of the benchmark for community ambulation, meaning walking outside the home, maybe with minimal help.
That's the classic teaching, yeah. Because an L5 level usually means the key muscles needed for walking are working reasonably well.
But what happens if the function stops higher up, say at L3?
Well, an L3 level means impaired quadriceps function. The big muscle on the front of the thigh isn't working properly.
Ah, and that's crucial for straightening the knee, right?
Absolutely critical. So without good quad function, the ability to brace the knee, to extend it for stable walking, it's significantly limited. Ambulation often gets restricted just to the home environment and usually requires pretty substantial bracing, like orthotics.
So that key takeaway is, you really need working quads for community ambulation.
Explicitly, yes. That's a powerful predictor. Though we always have to remember, you know, things like body weight, motivation, therapy, they all play a role too. It's not completely set in stone.
Makes sense. Now, beyond just walking ability, that functional level also creates problems with muscle imbalance, doesn't it? Especially around the hip. We see patterns of instability, contractures.
Oh, the muscle imbalance is relentless. It's a central problem. What happens is the hip flexors and the adductors, the muscles pulling the leg up and in the floor, they often work okay because their nerve supply comes from higher up, like L1 to L3.
Okay.
But the muscles that extend the hip and pull it outwards, the extensors and abductors, they rely on L4 and L5 nerves, which are often the ones affected by the myelomeningocele.
So you've got functional muscles pulling in one direction and weak or non-functional muscles opposing them, an unopposed pull.
Exactly. It's like a constant tug of war where one side always wins.
Mm-hmm.
And that constant pull leads to flexion contractures, adduction contractures.
The hip gets stuck bent and pulled inwards.
Precisely. And over time, this can cause the hip joint itself to become unstable. It might subluxate, develop abnormally, which we call dysplasia, or even dislocate completely.
And that's driven by the neurology, not just a bone problem.
Fundamentally, yes. It's the neurological imbalance causing the progressive deformity. And then you get secondary problems, those contractures, plus maybe pelvic obliquity, the pelvis tilting, it really messes up sitting balance.
Which leads to?
Pressure sores, skin breakdown, especially over the sitting bones, the ischium. This becomes a huge management headache later in life, just maintaining skin integrity.
Wow. Okay. If we move down the leg to the foot and ankle, club foot is mentioned as being common, often on both sides.
Very common, yes. Bilateral club foot is frequent.
But how is this club foot different from the usual idiopathic kind we see in newborns?
The main difference is rigidity. The club foot you see with myelomeningocele tends to be much, much stiffer.
Why is that?
It stems from that underlying neuromuscular imbalance again. Plus, often there's more significant fibrosis in the soft tissues. It's not just the bones being out of position.
So does the standard treatment like Ponseti casting work as well?
We always try it first. It's still the standard initial approach. But honestly, the recurrence rates are quite high because of that rigidity and underlying imbalance.
Meaning surgery is often needed?
Frequently, yes. Surgical soft tissue releases are often required down the line to get the foot corrected and, importantly, keep it corrected.
That focus on managing these lifelong orthopedic consequences really underscores the impact. It's a marathon, not a sprint. Maybe let's pause here for a second and shift focus upstream towards prevention. Before we get deeper into management, just how common is spina bifida? And crucially, are there things we can do to prevent it?
Good point. And just a reminder for everyone listening, we have been talking about a chapter from the free and peer-reviewed textbook, Orthopedia, at www.orthopedia.com, edited by Bernstein, Penny, and Vea. But before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us. Read the book.
Okay, so epidemiology. The sources say spina bifida is still the most common major birth defect.
It is, yes, despite everything we know now.
And the risk for the general population is what, about 0.1%? Seems low, but...
Right. 1 in 1,000, roughly, for overt spina bifida. But that number changes dramatically if there's a family history.
How dramatically?
It really jumps. If a family already has one child with spina bifida, the risk for the next child goes up to about 5%. That's a 50-fold increase.
Wow.
And if there are two affected siblings, the risk is estimated around 40%. It's a huge genetic component, clearly.
Are there other factors, racial or environmental?
Yes. There's variation. Incidence differs quite a bit geographically. And Caucasians are noted to generally have a higher risk compared to some other groups globally.
Okay, let's talk prevention. The big one seems to be maternal folate insufficiency, right?
Absolutely. This is the single biggest modifiable risk factor we know of. It's actually a major public health success story.
So what's the recommendation?
The standard advice is 0.4 milligrams per day of folic acid supplementation for all women of childbearing age. Not just when they're planning pregnancy, but throughout those years.
And that simple step makes a difference.
A huge difference. It's estimated to decrease the risk of having a child with a neural tube defect like spina bifida by about 70%. It's incredibly effective.
70%? That's massive. Are there situations where even more folate might be needed?
Yes, definitely. Women taking certain medications, particularly some anticonvulsants like valproic acid, have a much higher risk. For them, the recommended folate dose might need to be up to 10 times higher, like 4 milligrams per day. That's something they need to discuss carefully with their doctor.
Good to know. Any other risk factors?
Maternal obesity is one. And maternal diabetes, both pre-existing and gestational, also increase the risk. But really, the folate story is key. And things like fortifying grain products with folic acid, as done in the U.S. and other countries, have demonstrably lowered the birth rates. Hashtag TagSaneBC, diagnosis, management, and crucial red flags.
All right, shifting back to clinical practice, how are these conditions typically picked up, and what are the immediate things clinicians need to watch out for?
Well, the more severe forms, myelomeningocele and meningocele, they're often detected before birth and now using routine prenatal ultrasound. If not picked up then, they're usually pretty obvious visually right at birth because of the sac or lesion on the back.
And occulta, the hidden one.
Occulta is trickier by definition. Sometimes there might be a little clue on the skin overlying the spine, maybe a small hairy patch, a dimple, or a birthmark. But honestly, most of the time, it's found completely by chance on an x-ray or an MRI that was ordered for totally unrelated reasons, like back pain later in life.
Okay, let's pause on a really critical safety point here, latex allergy. The sources emphasize this is a major issue in this patient group.
It absolutely is. Extremely high incidence. Probably due to repeated exposure to latex during multiple surgeries, procedures, catheterizations, starting from infancy.
So for anyone interacting with these patients?
It's non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. You must use non-latex gloves, non-latex equipment, catheters, everything. Assume allergy until proven otherwise. Anaphylaxis is a real risk.
Got it. Okay, moving to ongoing management. You said earlier there's no cure, so it's about managing the complications.
Exactly. It's a lifelong, multidisciplinary effort. You need neurosurgery involved, pediatric surgery, urology is huge because of the bladder issues, physical therapy, orthotics, the whole team.
What about fetal surgery? We hear about repairing the myelomeningocele in utero. Is that changing things?
It's still considered somewhat experimental, but yes, there's growing evidence and interest. The idea is that closing the defect before birth might protect the exposed spinal cord from further damage caused by the amniotic fluid. It seems to show promise, particularly in potentially reducing the need for shunting for hydrocephalus later on, and maybe improving motor outcomes slightly. But it's complex surgery with risks for both mother and baby.
A piece of the puzzle, but not a magic bullet.
Precisely. And within orthopedics itself, one of the really big debates, year after year, is what to do about those dislocated hips we talked about earlier.
Right, so why wouldn't you surgically fix a dislocated hip in a child, especially if mobility is a goal?
It seems counterintuitive, doesn't it? But the reality is complex. Firstly, the rate of the hip re-dislocating after surgery is incredibly high, sometimes 80 or 90%.
Wow.
The underlying muscle imbalance is still there, pulling it back out. Secondly, and maybe more importantly, the goals often shift. For many kids with higher lesions, achieving stable, independent walking isn't realistic. The priority becomes achieving a stable, level pelvis for comfortable sitting and preventing pressure sores.
Ah, I see. And surgery could mess that up.
Exactly. An attempted hip reduction that fails or results in a stiff, maybe abducted hip can actually make sitting worse. It can worsen pelvic obliquity and increase pressure sore risk. So preserving skin integrity and good sitting function often takes priority over chasing perfect hip anatomy on an x-ray. Benign neglect is often the preferred path for bilateral dislocations.
So surgery might only be considered for a unilateral dislocation, maybe in a child who is expected to be a community ambulator, trying to stabilize that one good leg.
That's generally the thinking, yes. If a child is already beating the odds and walking well in the community, you might consider surgery on one dislocated side to try and prolong that function, but it's a selective indication.
Okay. And other soft tissue issues, those flexion contractures. Club foot.
Yeah. Significant flexion contractures, say more than 20 degrees at the hip or knee, often do need surgical release, like hamstring lengthening, to improve function or positioning. And that rigid club foot, as we said, often needs more than just casting. Surgical releases are common because recurrence is such a big problem.
Okay, finally, let's really hammer home the immediate danger signs, the red flags. What are the things that need urgent attention?
Any acute change in neurological function is a red flag. That means worsening leg weakness, changes in sensation, new bowel or bladder problems, or changes in gait if they are ambulatory.
And what could those changes signal?
It signals something is potentially going wrong with the spinal cord or brain, requiring urgent neurosurgical evaluation. We worry about four main things primarily. One is spinal cord tethering. As the child grows, the spinal cord, which might be scarred down at the repair site, gets stretched.
Ouch.
Yeah. Second is worsening hydrocephalus, the fluid buildup in the brain, maybe the shunt they have isn't working properly. Third is development of a syrinx, which is a fluid-filled cyst within the spinal cord itself causing pressure. And the fourth is problems related to the Arnold-Chiari malformation.
Arnold-Chiari. We hear that term a lot with spina bifida. What exactly is it and why is it dangerous?
It's very common in myelomeningocele cell. It's where parts of the cerebellum, the back part of the brain, and sometimes the brainstem, herniate downwards through the opening at the base of the skull, the foramen magnum. This can compress the brainstem and cause all sorts of problems, breathing difficulties, swallowing issues, cranial nerve problems, worsening limb function. Any new symptom suggestive of that needs immediate assessment.
So any change is a big deal, and constant vigilance regarding skin.
Absolutely critical. Because sensation is decreased below the functional level, they can develop serious pressure ulcers without even feeling them. Regular skin checks are vital. Also, an acute limb red hot swollen thing fracture first, or infection. They have fragile bones and decreased sensation. Hashtag tag V. Reviewing the five key concepts. Okay, so that was a lot. Maybe let's quickly boil it down to five key concepts that really capture the essence of what we've discussed about spina bifida.
Good idea. Okay, concept number one, spina bifida occulta. Remember, this is the common, usually benign one.
Right. Bony defect only, no neural involvement, high prevalence, low clinical impact generally.
Second, meningocele. What's the key anatomical point here?
The sac contains meninges and fluid, but crucially, no spinal cord or neural elements. That's the big difference from myelomeningocele, predicting a generally milder course.
Third, myelomeningocele. This is the most severe type.
Yeah. The spinal cord is involved in the protruding sac, leads to that uniform nerve dysfunction below the lesion, requiring intensive, lifelong, multidisciplinary care. Neurosurgery, urology, orthopedics, the whole team.
Fourth key concept. Maternal folate insufficiency.
This is the big one for prevention. It's a major modifiable risk factor. Remember the guideline, 0.4 milligrams per day for women of childbearing age can cut the risk by around 70%.
Huge impact. And finally, number five, the lower extremity conditions seen with myelomeningocele.
Right. Understanding the why behind them. It's that specific pattern of muscle imbalance, the L1, L3 hip flexors and adductors overpowering the often non-functional L4, L5 extensors and abductors.
Rallying too.
Leading to hip subluxation, dislocation, contractures, and also contributing to that characteristic rigid clubfoot deformity. Understanding the imbalance is key to understanding the orthopedic challenges.
Excellent summary. Yeah. You know, navigating the management of spina bifida from trying to prevent it with folate right through to these complex surgical decisions later in life, it really highlights the challenges. And thinking about the future, things like fetal surgery versus those ethical debates on, say, operating on a hip versus prioritizing sitting function, these are conversations that will keep evolving and shaping quality of life for these individuals.
Absolutely. It's a field with ongoing challenges and advancements. We have just discussed a chapter from the world's best free and peer-reviewed textbook of musculoskeletal medicine, Orthopedia, by Bernstein, Penny, and Viette. It is available at www.orthopedia.com at no charge. And again, before you take a test, and certainly before you take care of a patient, don't rely on us to read the book. You'll be glad you did.